by the politicians, especially not by Giolitti, and some people have doubts about their functionality. So they are really rather low-grade public servants, and there's a lot of disprezzo, there's a lot of despising of the military in society at large. There are one or two problems, there are many problems, but there are one or two problems that where we don't have evidence about things that are obviously important. And one of the most significant of those is the relationship between the army and the chief of the general staff and the crown. And I put a bit about this, particularly the historical bit, to try to explain why it is that the crown is very important in the constitutional and functional structure of Italy. And we do know that the crown, through intermediaries, particularly the military chief aide-de-camp, kept fairly close touch with the military, and we do know that he was informed about a great deal. Exactly how much, we don't know. And we don't know because we don't have the Royal Archives. The Royal Archives were taken to Cascais in Portugal in 1948. They moved to Switzerland a couple of years ago when the Italian state gave the crown an amnesty. The condition was that the archives would be brought back and put into state hands. Nobody in Italy believes that will ever happen. If it does happen, it will be after I'm dead, I'm sure. That leaves us...
Where is it exactly?
In Switzerland, I don't know. I know where it was in Portugal, but nobody can get at it. Nobody can get at it. And there are a lot of reasons which I could explain later on about why they won't be able to get at it.
Surely the Ticino.
So that leaves us with problems, because there may be, well, the big problem, of course, is the change of political mind in Italy between the 1st and 2nd of August 1914. And in effect, as far as I'm aware, nobody has found any evidence to explain why that decision was taken from documentary sources. We know it was, and we can try to reconstruct it. So, all along then, the military and the chiefs of general staff regard themselves in several senses as servants of the crown. What that, and again listening to you guys and comparing what you were talking about with what I now work on, what that reinforced in me was the sense that the culture of this institution was a very dominating force. And that term culture can be used very widely. There is a planning culture, there is a political culture, there is a control culture, and then there is part of the general Italian culture at large. Now, that means that there are visible forces at work, and we can sketch a little of those in things like the constitutional arrangements and the structural arrangements vis-à-vis the War Office, which I talk about in the paper. There are invisible forces at work which you would not know about if you didn't understand Italian culture. For example, we've talked a number of times, haven't we, and I think Dick raised it in his introduction, about the issue of whether people from within the general staff challenged the products of the general staff, and if so, what happened, and if not, why not? It's effectively inconceivable that anybody inside the Italian general staff would challenge the product of authority. It's inconceivable because of the bureaucratic structures that control the military and a lot else in Italian life. It's inconceivable because of the attitude to authority. There's a famous Italian saying that the servant tethers the donkey where the master wants it. And that goes for everything. You don't challenge your authority. You might evade it, or you might not do what it wants, but you don't challenge it. So both the military culture and the constitutional and political culture produce a system which is, in a sense, rather subservient and, in a sense, rather passive. That then, I suppose, leads went on to think a bit about the cast of characters, and particularly the chiefs of the general staff, and I talk a bit about them. I think the crucial thing about them is that the Italian general staff starts to become more modern, starts to become more Germanized, in a sense, from 1896, when this man called Tancredi Saletta becomes chief of the general staff. And as I describe, he introduces the practices that some of you guys are familiar with, though not the Brits at that stage, staff rides, staff exercises, and so on and so forth. But that remains a very limited reform. It's very difficult to test exactly how deeply it goes because most of the documentation isn't there. So one's working from the sense one's got of what is available. So this then is a general staff. In a sense, although there's no direct comparison, it's a bit like the British general staff, a latecomer and one which in certain functional and professional respects is certainly not in the first league, may not even be in the second league. The personality and I think the direction that the chief of the general staff gives is important, but it's only important within the ongoing flow of analysis that the general staff is making, which is, as I explained at the beginning, a very isolated body in the Italian army and one that people don't like very much. I don't know whether it's more disliked than in other armies, but it is certainly disliked in the Italian army. But I think Saletta is the first real dedicated professional, and he surveys the strategic scene for Italy and throws light on the problems. Pollio is a convinced Triplicista. Italian historians, such as they are, and they tended to be writing in the 1930s about this, tried to portray Pollio as keeping something of a distance from the Germans. They had political reasons for doing that at that time. There's nothing been written about him since, effectively. But, particularly in the evidence that's in the paper, leads me to believe that he was a convinced Triplicista. His death, I think, on the 1st of July, effectively changed nothing, in that Cadorna believed even more in July 1914 in supporting the Germans. So the only effect of this change at the top was to reinforce the strategy that the Italian general staff had by that time devised. Perceived threats, needs, and the relationship between those and the politicians. Probably what I need to emphasise more in the paper, which I did do in the piece for Ernie May, but becomes very, I think, dominant, is essentially that the Italians are defensive in metropolitan Italy, even though they may be aggressive overseas. That is to say, from the 1880s, actually, they have plans for overseas expeditions. Nobody has ever found these plans, by the way, so we know they existed, but we don't know what they looked like, but they were there. And of course, they go into Eritrea in the early 1880s, they go into Libya in 1911. But, and this is reinforced by the strategic survey that Saletta does in the late 1890s of the eastern and western frontier, the Italians are always domestically defensive. They are concerned about protecting Italy against France on the one hand, against Austria on the other. The third problem for them, which is much more dominant in the 1880s and 1890s, it's still there, but to a lesser extent after 1900, is the problem of the exposed body of Italy to invasion. And that never really goes away, though it does diminish after, for obvious reasons, after about 1905-6 because of the change in the diplomatic orientation. So what are the strategic problems that the Italian general staff and the chiefs face? Well, in a sense, they've got a problem, and again, I hadn't really conceived of it in quite the close terms I needed to until yesterday, that they either face, how many wars do they face? How many wars does Conrad face? Well, the Italians face either one, or one and a half, or two, or possibly three different theatres. If they're fighting against France, and that is the preoccupation up until about 1906, 1907, then they face three different theatres, obviously. They face possible war in the Alps. They have the Rhine contribution, which from 1888 is an ongoing consideration. And, of course, they face the possibility of invasion. So there are three different but simultaneous strategic problems to deal with. If they are going to face war against Austria, then they've got one and a half wars, really, to deal with. One is the land war on the Eastern Front. The half is Switzerland, because the Italians are always worried about Switzerland as an avenue of penetration, possibly from the Germans, possibly from the Italians, if Doug were here, possibly from the French. So, partly for that reason, partly because politically, Italy is not an aggressive power, as we all know, and as Richard Bosworth showed years ago, Italy is a power, and as Bismarck said, you know, large appetite and rotten teeth. Italy is always going to be a power that tries to pick the crumbs from the other great powers' table, but it will not start a European war in order to get those crumbs. Under some politicians, particularly under Crespi, of course, in the late 1880s, it would join in a European war with the Germans if it could get something out of this. But by 1900 to 1914, that position, I think, has changed. So, for cultural, traditional, and, if you like, geographical, strategic reasons, the general staff produce a set of strategic postures. And their planning is planning for mobilization of a fairly complicated system of regulars and reserves, but of course complicated even more by the shape of Italy and the problem of communications and the lack of railways. That's a specific example of a problem that all powers have, but it's never quite the same in any one of the powers. Their strategic plans then are deployment plans, first of all in the West and then after 1907, 1908 in the East. And those plans essentially are no more than how the army is to be got, or the armies are to be got to a particular point, and where that point is. Because once after 1907 the concentration is on the East, then it's really a question of which river line you defend. And the Italians move backwards gradually in those years in deciding where they are going to stand and fight. But their strategies then always presume a defensive and then possibly a counter-offensive afterwards. But in the planning, as all the rest of us have said, they don't really go beyond the first opening moments of the conflict. It's then going to work itself out. This is one dimension of planning, but there's a second dimension, and I think I'm going to bring this out more in the final version of the paper, and that is the complications that can be induced for the Italian general staff, either by the politicians or by the force of circumstances, because communications between the military and the civilian politicians are appalling in Italy. They're virtually non-existent. But we don't know what role the Crown played. The Crown might have played quite a significant role from time to time. We had no idea about that. So what we see is extremely poor civil military communications, and there are a whole number of reasons for that. So what are these problems in practice? Well, one problem is exemplified by the decision to invade Libya in 1911, which is something that is sprung on the military by the politicians with about 4 or 5 weeks' notice as a result of a couple of people meeting in a hotel one weekend. It's not true, though Bosworth, who ought to have known better, said it was true. It's not true that the staff didn't have plans for a Libyan campaign. They had plans, but they weren't expecting to have to put them into operation out of the blue, as they did. So Libya in 1911 represents one kind of a strategic problem for the staff. The other kind of strategic problem is actually the Balkans in 1912. It's much smaller, I now realise, but it's there. And there's a little bit about it in the paper, but I will readjust that, because what it forces the Italian general staff to do is to be prepared to divert some troops to yet another problem. And so they have to prepare that small but significant expeditionary force in 1912. And they have to be ready for the politicians to say, go do it. And Pollio complains repeatedly about this. So those are two different kinds of problems that are added to the kind of menu of strategic issues that the Italians have to deal with. Very few of the planning documents actually survive to tell us anything much about the planning process. What does survive is the memoranda, these things called projects that I was talking about yesterday, which do detail the deployment decisions that the staff make. There's one whole missing area which may be important, and your paper, Bruce, made me conscious of it, and that is that in Italy there are five very important people, and those are the five designated army commanders in wartime. The Third Army is going to the Rhine, there are five of them. We know that these people meet periodically. We don't know what they say. There is no extant records of what they, or there are no extant records of what they talked about, except on one occasion, which I'll come back to in just a moment. It's also true that the Italian general staff seems actually rather like the Royal Navy. It seems to have adopted a planning procedure, at least in the early period, in which it identified a general strategic problem and then wrote to the army commands and said, now, how do you think you in Verona or you in Udine or wherever should solve the problem from your perspective? Very much like the way the Royal Navy treated the naval commands. Very little survives of that process, partly because there are no war ministry archives in Italy, or effectively there are no war ministry archives. So again, we don't know much about that. All we know is that it was going on. Incidentally, the only place, time, in which we do know about that meeting is after Pollio dies. After Pollio dies, the five designated army commanders are called together by the chief military aide-de-camp of the king, a man called General Ugo Brusati. And that's a very interesting moment. I think it's a much more positive moment than it's been portrayed and that you naturally picked up on, Dick, because Pollio's death is entirely unexpected, and these guys are offered a choice between a young major general called Ozio, who's in his early 50s and is very energetic, and the somewhat older Cadorna, and they're given a vote. And they vote 3-2 for Cadorna. And so Cadorna gets the job. That may be a good way of doing things, or it may not be a good way of doing things. Just what happened.
Beats meeting somebody in the cigar store.
and along comes Cadorna. So that's quite a lot, but all prompted thoughts about dimensions of these problems are prompted by what you guys have said. Two other things I'll say, and then I'll stop. This paper quite justifiably may not excite any of you, but pretty much all the documentation that is in it for the period from 1912 onward has never been seen since 1934, and I found it in the archives. You were talking about the 1912 memorandum that you couldn't find. I don't know whether this stuff was just misfiled or whether it was deliberately hidden. If so, probably by another historian who didn't want some of the facts. But I found it by the sort of means that we know as historians about how our noses work. So I think there is actually quite a lot of communication going on between the Austrians, the Italians and the Germans in 1930 and 1940. I think one of the things you can't say is that the military side of the 1940 crisis in this respect is due to poor communications. They're talking, it seems to me, a lot to each other, and there may even be more than I've got here, but there's quite a lot that I've got here. And also, as we know, they're doing a lot of preparations in terms of the railway work, for example, to be able to do these things if they have to do them. Now, I don't know what the German and Austrian records of the Salzburg conference in October 1913 are, and I would very much like to know what they are. But the crucial thing that I think about the record I found is that there is this brief description that is given to Pollio, or confirmation of what the Italian forces will do if war begins and if the Third Army goes to the Rhine. And this is where I think, while I buy a lot of your criticism, Stig, of Zuber, there are still some bits of Zuber which stand up to me, and one of them is the idea that the annual manoeuvres, not manoeuvres, but the staff exercises reflect what they really intended to do, if they could. And that's what Pollio's told. In October 1913, he's told, if this happens, you'll be smashing through, we should be smashing through this central French barrier. Come 1914, of course, nothing of this ever happens because the political decision is taken in these mysterious circumstances you still really don't know about, that Italy will stay neutral. Probably a lot of contributing things to this, and I should say something in the paper, I think, about the economic consequences of the Libyan War, which were very considerable. I did say things about this in other places, but I think I should probably put them in here. We don't, by the way, if there are any Treasury Ministry papers, nobody has ever got hold of them in Italy. So we can't fill in the story from the Treasury side either. So there may be economic dimensions to this, but as yet we're not able to do any more than hazard guesses. Cadorna, deeply frustrated, I think, in 1914, but changes horses very, very smoothly and begins to think about the new sets of problems that he's got. You will give me guidance as to whether you want me to go any further into that at the end of the paper. I didn't in the one I gave you because it sort of opened up a whole new set of issues about the period 1914-15. I can't resist saying, by way of conclusion, though, that in one sense, Italy seems to be the only power who goes into the war with a political diplomatic calculation consciously backing the military one. Maybe the wrong calculation, but they had their shopping list, and in April 1915, having tried to sell it to the Austrians and tried to sell it to the Allies, they sell it to the Allies, and then they enter the war.
And much more rational.
So it is rational. There you are. Those are the thoughts.
I've got three things I wanted to ask you about. One, you said that there was no immediate war that had an impact on, there's no Russian-Japanese war. I was wondering if you could talk just a tad about Libya.
Yeah.
The second one, this whole issue, one of the things you don't talk at all about, or very just briefly about, is naval things.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that the British believe is that one of the reasons why the Italians stayed at war is because the Royal Navy can both destroy the Italian economy and, of course, shell the Italian coastline.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there's anything to that. And a third one is David Stevenson, in his book on arms races, talks a great deal about the interlocking arms races in the Balkans before the First World War. And I was wondering, and he talks about Italy in this, and I was wondering to what extent do the arms races affect the Italian awareness of how prepared they are for a war, where exactly they stand militarily and the like, and if that has any effect on how the Italian general staff views their possibilities.
Right, right. Libya, first of all, well, Libya is a test, firstly, of certain things, as we all know, particularly primitive use of airplanes by the Italian troops. Then, of course, the bulk of war sees a rapid expansion of that issue of the use of airplanes. The Libyan war very quickly degenerates into a nasty slogging match with some really quite bad atrocities on the Italian side, and the demonstration that they are not powerful enough, either in numbers or weapons or techniques, to be able to get very much farther than the coastal strip of Libya. When they do penetrate inland, one or two of their columns are massacred, and by 1914 they've been pushed back to just four spots on the coast of Libya. Oh yes, there's someone at the door.
What about their logistics?
We don't know much. The Navy seems to have been able to keep them supplied. I've not come across, in the limited reading I've done on it, any evidence of things like ammunition shortages or weapons shortages, though I've only read secondary stuff. I haven't looked at any primary material on it. It's there.
How many troops were there?
Oh, gosh.
Approximately?
I can't remember, but I think one's probably talking about 70,000, 80,000. And it goes up.
And they raid the stocks, which is one of the problems in 1940.
They've drawn down stocks.
Yes,
and
Libya.
That is actually admitted to Parliament in 1913. And one of the problems, is rebuilding stocks. Mm-hmm. We have no figures on this other than the economic figures that the War Minister gives the Chamber of Deputies. Mm-hmm. There are some guesses about what the real costs were, but we don't have any other sources, not that I'm aware of, any other sources of numbers. So Libya starts to look horribly like Eritrea and Ethiopia in a certain respect. There are also questions raised about Italian generalship. Canova, the commander, is brought back, having really rather failed. Although, this is another thing, this is tangential. Another set of influential people in Italy are the very small numbers of people called Generali d'Esercito. They would be five-star generals. You're given the rank of general of the army. Canova gets it as a result of leading a successful campaign. And that means you are then consulted about strategy. But there's no record of what these consultations are.
So you're the general of but you don't really command anything.
It's an honorific title after you have
failed.
Or at least being responsible for a campaign.
Strategos.
Yeah. I could say a bit more in print about Libya, but I think that essentially what it really is a drain. Naval things.
Just for a moment, stick to that problem. Is there any debate amongst the leading Italian military men about the character of that campaign in Libya? Because what comes to mind is, first of all, the similarity to Adwa and the whole thing in Eritrea, and also the fact that this kind of warfare continues well into the 20s.
Yeah, until 1931.
And then, of course, Abyssinia.
That's a very good question. There's no... There is a little debate that I'm aware of. There are two Italian military newspapers, and they're most useful for... they're published about once a week, and they reflect different political views within the military world, and they therefore reproduce a dimension of the debates. But they're very limited. I'm not aware of any professional debates about tactics, operational methods, and so on. That material may exist or may have existed in the Scuola di Guerra, in the War Academy. But nobody knows if there are any records for that. And there's no history of it ever been written, and so it's pretty much a blank.
Yeah, because of the time span, you know, it's quite...
It's close.
Unlikely that they really were teaching
that. That was the other thing I was going to say. Yeah, the war comes on them so fast that they don't... It's no longer relevant. What matters is hanging on to the fringe of Libya until you can go back after the war and sort it out, which Graziani does in the later 1920s. Mm-hmm. The naval things. The Italian Navy has obviously declined in size and importance from the position it was in the 1880s, and it's being threatened from 1911-12 by the rise of the Austrian Navy and the Adriatic problem. Mm-hmm. In the earlier period, there is an acute anxiety that the French, particularly, but brackets anybody, will appear and bombard coastal Italy. And there are very good reasons to be anxious about it. The concrete reasons are the troubles in Sicily in 1890s, the near revolt of the working class in 1898 in the north, all the socialist anti-militarist agitation, which is of course going on in June 1914 and therefore preoccupying the politicians and the military. And there is a belief, secondly, that the Italian state is so new that nobody really believes in it, and it will fall apart if the population is bombarded. This view is very strong, up until 1908-1909, which is the last time that I know of any round the table discussions about this problem. That certainly is there on the eve of the war. I've never seen any mention of it specifically in the context of the British. It's always talked about vis-a-vis the French, but the general strategic alarm is there. Interestingly, although this is not for this conference, I'm now working on the 20s and 30s, it's gone. Even in the 1920s, as a strategic anxiety, it's gone. Anyway, that's a whole other matter. The effect on the economy, I can't help doing these comparisons because it's what I'm working on now. There's a great deal of discussion in the Italian Navy in the 1920s about the economic importance of the Navy, of supply lines, of where supplies are going to come from. But that is a consequence of the First World War. Mm-hmm. So before the First World War, I have not seen any significant debate about protection of the supply lines and these sorts of things. Because the impression you get is that the Italian, and this is what they say, the Italian Navy's sort of sole strategic, it has its own defeat, of course, in the back of its mind, at Lissa. The Italian Navy's conception is if the enemy appears, well, this is what they say they will do, if the enemy appears off the coastline, then they will sail out and do some kind of Bahamian for them Götterdämmerung type battle.
All big gun shootout.
That's what they say in 1908. So there are anxieties. Naval strategy, they haven't translated Mahan. They don't actually translate Mahan in full until the 1990s. But they do know Mahan's ideas through various published means, and they are very, they're very popular in Italy, like everywhere else. So they have a sort of a simplified Mahanian concept. What they're increasingly concerned about from 1912 is the Adriatic. And that just drifts, carries on over through the First World War and into the 20s and into the 30s, and it starts at about that time. Balkan arms races. I mean, we're really in a fix because we don't have any war ministry papers. I can't give you an answer. There may be material. The military attaché's reports have survived in fairly good condition for before 1914. There may be material in the reports of the Balkan military attaché's. I've never looked through that material. I don't know. And we don't have what we would want, which is the sort of records of any kind of group meeting which might identify this as a problem. So the inference must be that they were concerned. Spending does start to go up. They are watching everybody. Well, everybody's watching everybody before 1914. But I couldn't say with any specificity.
John, have you thought of looking at the British military attaché's reports? Because that's exactly the kind of thing that they look at in the country they're accredited to. They do it in Russia, they do it everywhere. That might be an indirect way of getting some idea of what, because, I mean, that's their business to know.
They are quite good at all the things we know. You know, I always say it's a bit soap and socks, a lot of military attaché's reports, but they're very good at doing the budgets and if there are public parliamentary debates on. Yeah, that's a good idea. Also, I may actually, going on a trip in about 3 weeks' time, I may be able to steal a bit of time out of that and have a look at the Italian versions to see. So, yeah, that may be fillable in.
John, you you already know it probably, but I found it immensely useful to look through the printed compilations, the annual reports of the British military attachés in the MOD library, and they're readily accessible, and they're quite good.
Yeah. In the days when I used to be a British military historian, the MOD library shut down for about 2 years.
Oh,
when
wow.
It moved, and so I never did look at that stuff. But yeah, that's a good idea.
Guy, Charles. Used to be just tremendously helpful, Charles Potts, but he's retired.
Yep, I remember.
The other possible place in the British archives is the annual reports.
You mean the published, those no. things in the confidential print?
If they're in the confidential print, or they're also in FO-374.
Yeah.
The annual report always has a big section on the military.
Things
where you can grab material.
Yeah.
John, we've talked about this earlier, and I think since Richard and I are going to write something on general staffs in the front, I think some of those first 5-6 pages could be condensed, which I will give right back to you around page 38, because I think any reader is going to all of a sudden say, my God, this is a fantasy strategy. Because you read through this, and 1 minute, we may be in the Maritime Alps, we may be in Provence, we may be somewhere in Elsass, in Lorraine. You mentioned a couple of possible spots. How specific, I don't know. We may have had the book Alistair Horne written about the Italians at Verdun. And then all of a sudden, Moltke Valders, they say, oh, God, no, send your cavalry to Galicia. And, you know, maybe around there, and I mean fantasy strategy, not in a derogatory term, but the reader is going to say, by 1913, my God, the Italians are talking about landing in the mouth of the Rhone River, or they may be in Lorraine, or they may be out in Galicia. Of course, they got to watch the damn Swiss and anybody coming through the Gotthard Pass, so that you really end up in 1913 with just all these pregnant choices.
Yeah.
You know, it's just dramatic reading as hell, and you wonder, holy Toledo, poor old Polio and his people. You know, I mean, this is quite a thing. Talk about logistics, the Navy, amphibious landings, the railroads, and of course Conrad has nothing but trains available, 541, to shuttle the Italians up, and you're really left there by saying, that beehive of activity.
Yeah. I was going to say is that's part of that strategy determination is how do you prioritize your strategies. And your comment reminds me of, this is one that Stig, you probably know it, but it's that wonderful quote in Bill Fuller's Strategy and Power in Russia when Waldersee in the 1890s gets instructions to begin working up a war plan against Russia. And his response is, why attack Russia? They have no money and we don't need their land. But that's actually, I was going to ask the same thing that Keith was asking about Navy.
That was prior to reaction.
Exactly.
You know, when I read over those pages, you know, I was totally unaware of all of this, being ignorant on, of course, the Third Army to the Rhine and all this. But, you know, even from the German side, all of a sudden this total flip-flop, you know, by the way, we really don't need that. And the way this is all happening, you know, send your cavalry divisions out to Galicia.
I think this is probably because it's hard to evaluate whether these agreements are meant to be, in the first place, are meant to be really military planning or political tools to make the Italians stick to the alliance.
It's the same problem we run into in the contemporary world with these biannual and more these issuings of the U.S. national security strategy. One of the questions we always ask the officers, for whom are these statements meant? Is it for internal consumption, for external consumption, for both? How do they affect planning, that sort of thing?
And you're absolutely right. There's just this a tremendous amount of discussion, especially in 1913, you know, when Polio comes up for maneuvers and Hans Ferdinand is up and they're racing out to the Kiel Regatta and then out to Schlesien to Salzburg, you know, and you sort of leave it in there around this page as almost this kind of dramatic climax where the reader says, what the hell are they going to do?
I didn't think they knew what they were.
But that is also a conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. I fully agree, Bruce. You know, and you know, use some extra space on there because the plot thickens.
Again, the Leavenworth, no decision is also a decision.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, I picked up on the same thing that Keith did, and in part, it's just because of where I've taught for the last 10 years is. Looking at the relationships, especially any planning relationships with the Navy, I think you've already addressed that. And plus, I don't know how many more rocks your rucksack can take. But at the same time, what one of the issues that you raised, and sort of in nice relief for me again, is getting back to this issue that Dick raised in his draft introductory essay, and that is, you get down to a subset of it, but it's elite culture, and then subcultures within the elite, subcultures within the military, and the way those relate to larger society and so on. And one of the what you said about the subservient aspect of the Italian general staff is just the opposite of what I had a general staff Italian officer tell me about 5 years ago about he said, my job is when the chief walks in and proposes a course of action is to attack that in every way possible. So that we, in the end, and he said, I may be, shit can, pardon my, but he said, that's our job. But the interesting thing is the way that interacts, because it came back and reminded me, I mean, your usual, not yours, but the self-effacing British way, this is not so important. But on the other hand, what it does is it tells me what I need to look for. Because in the Russian, I don't want to keep being on Russian, but there are differences even within the mafia that Sukumlinov brings in. And they're differences by experience. Alexeyev is not at least a direct part of that mafia, but there's a difference between him. He's very diplomatic, but in his letters he despises Danilov. And you look at that, is it because Danilov is lesser intellectually, which he probably is, but Danilov is still capable. But it comes down to the fact that Danilov was a staff officer with no combat experience. Mm-hmm. And Alexeyev had served in combat in 1877-78. He'd been chief of staff of the 3rd Manchurian Army in 1904 and 5 while Danilov was sitting on the main staff. And so you get, even in right now in contemporary military terms, there is a vast difference in the American Army, for example, between the guy who's wearing the combat patch on his left shoulder and those who don't have that combat patch on their left shoulder.
Interesting. I mean, I wish Doug were here, because one of the issues we know, don't we, is this question of the extent to which the French army was advantaged or disadvantaged by its colonial experience, mm-hmm. and the existence of, Girardet talked about it 40 years ago, the colonial clique or the colonial
yes.
group in the French army.
Very much
In the Italian army, it's not like that, because no colonial clique is ever formed as such mm-hmm. in the way it is in France. The Metropolitan Army remains the Metropolitan Army. Bureaucratic, red tape ridden, mm-hmm. inert, slow. But that's where you make your career. And that's where you make your career politically. Politically and through the monarchy.
The other aspect, again, and you look at these sort of intra-elite conflicts, is because, like in the Russian situation, the general staff officer has a badge on his right pocket. And as soon as, like, if you're in the field in exercises, as soon as a general staff officer shows up, the field officers, they refer to them as pheasants. Or the other one is moments. Momenti, because one of the favorite general staff officers saying was, wait a moment while we think about this. So they call them moments. So there are all kinds of sort of formal and informal disjunctures that occur.
You prompt me to ask a question of everybody. One of the issues about clique masonry, Freemasonry, mm-hmm. there's mm-hmm. a great deal of supposition in the Italian writing, and Cadorna believed that he was a victim of the Freemasons. And Jews. I can't do much with this, because there's not much more than a fairly widespread belief that Freemasonry is operating at the higher reaches of the Italian army. Is this part of the cliques of the general staff in other armies?
Yes, Germany. Ludendorff, particularly after the war, explained the defeat of Germany by the machinations of Jews, Catholics, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. and Freemasons.
Mm-hmm.
And Ludendorff, much of his career, he actually has to be grateful to Hermann von Moltke, who sponsored him in the general staff. And Ludendorff always admired, perhaps too much, but had a positive relationship with the younger Moltke until his death. But later on, in his own self-justification about the war, Ludendorff would always describe the failure of the younger Moltke, the Battle of the Marne, as a result of the machinations of the Freemasons, mm-hmm. because Moltke was affiliated with Freemasons. In fact, he was interested, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there was his wife, Eliza von Moltke, who did all these strange religious things. So there was always this suspicion that this intellectual, he was kind of intellectual, this weakling, was under the influence of such non-national forces. So this played a role, but I don't think it's to the same extent as in Italy.
But there are very practical ways that this affects the way the general staff operates. Because, for example, when Sukhmelnikov brings his elite up from Kiev, Munkevitz, who is an intelligence officer, becomes the factotum for Danilov and will allow nobody in to see Danilov until you've first been vetted by Munkevitz. And then when he brings Lukomsky, the expert in mobilization, up, Lukomsky is still a colonel, and when he has to meet interdepartmentally, generals have to respond to him. In his large version of his memoirs, which the Russians have now published, he talks about for a year how much difficulty that was, because he had to walk into these meetings as a colonel before he finally made it to general.
John, let me ask one other question. Sort of the degree of specificity you can do. On page 22, we have five railway conventions between 91 and 98.
Yeah.
And do the Italians know how many men, how many trains?
They do
and
know.
Where the hell are they going? You mentioned Epinal, Belfort, the next page, Verdun. In other words, if you could maybe add a little bit, when we have these five railway conventions, is there some kind of specific number of trains, men, and where are they going?
I can tell you I can tell you that we know, but it's all done from the Austrian sources. The Italian side of the railway conventions don't exist. Or if they do exist, God knows where they are. But we do know the numbers of trains. From what I've read, I don't know. It doesn't say where they're going. I have put in the paper everything that there is in the Italian sources about the destinations. There isn't any more. And it's very frustrating because it's very fragmentary.
Yep.
But I can say something more about the sort of carrying capacities and so on.
Yeah. Just add to that point. You mentioned 541 trains. That comes sort of late. If you could give us the numbers, trains, number of people to be transported, put some numbers further up front, and let's let the reader know just what an awesome thing is we are planning and thinking about. Things I've read, we could talk about the trains, we're going to move up to the Rhine and so on, but it's all very sparse, so let's have much more detail. And I think at that point, and generally for you, and I think for everybody else, I think for you especially, given what you've told us, I think it would be useful to have a paragraph maybe up front, reviewing the fugitive character of the sources. We've got files that loop around Europe and never accessible. People read historical things and we have statements, here is the truth of the matter. I think the reader ought to be cued in that we've got kind of mystical things going on here and we might never know the answer. And here is why.
Well, I will happily do that if you wish. It's another world being an Italian military historian, believe you me, as far as sources go. Just one very small story to show you what there are effectively no Ministry of War papers. Neither are there for the fascist period. It's because, partly because Italian law, both before and after the Second World War, made the ministries responsible for their own records. As far as I'm aware, there was never, or at least not till very recently, a sort of a Public Records Act, as there was in England. So, the ministries gave whatever they wanted to the state archive, which when it was opened after the war. The War Ministry gave a chunk of extremely boring papers for about 3 years in the 1880s, a little bit of which I've quoted there. and there's nothing else. The historian who worked on this before, Mazzetti, who's a Neapolitan, Sicilian, knew the war ministry very well. And he used to go and take part in the six-monthly assessments for officers. And one day they hadn't got a room. They said, "Look, there's a room in the basement. It's full of papers." They took them out, threw them all in the incinerator to make room for this committee to meet.
I think some of this is nice. I mean, Bruce does it in his article, you know, in the footnotes, what of the Alexeyev papers were are not available, but some have been published. And if you could just indicate a little bit, I think Dick is to give the idea. How wherever, how difficult it is. It's not just I walk in and say, I want these papers, I want these, I want these. But you're putting pieces of a puzzle to coin together.
That's, you know, when John says about the story, that's I don't want to really that much tire you with a war story, but that's only the tip of that iceberg. What happens is the Alexeyev's daughter from Argentina deposited those papers at Lenin Library after the fall. The lady who is in charge of that collection would not let me in. And because she's working them up to create an edited collection, and usually you can override that, but she's the mistress of the head of the library.
And this is very Italian.
You're sitting there. Oh, okay.
Scarf up.
John, are there private papers for any people?
Now, this is another thing. Italian state law now says that any papers that anybody who's held an official position takes back to their home belong to the state. So there are very, very small number of private papers for anything in the modern fascist period the same available. And there are two reasons. One reason is the families are afraid that if they announce the existence of them, they will be seized, which they will be by the customs police, and taken away from them. The other reason is that quite a lot of people have varying degrees of things to hide. But the third thing is I talking to you, Keith, or somebody the other night. Until you get to the post-World War I period to a degree and then the fascist period, there's very little memoir material. There's a lot about the wars of the Risorgimento, but then it stops. And there's very little memoir material in Italy, and very little private papers. They may well be there, but they are not.
And why did the papers of the files of the general staff survive? You know, the war ministry.
I don't know. I would be guessing. Part of it, I think, is simply what was hidden away where in Rome in 1943, and some stuff was taken out of Rome in 1943. I might say a bit about the naval archives in a minute. And some of it survived, some of it was dispersed, some of it was collected back up together again. 1944, 1945. So a lot of it is happenstance, or appears to be. You can never believe anything in Italy. It's never straightforward. It appears to be happenstance. I'll tell you, I mean, I'm sorry about this, but I'll do one more. I'll tell you why you can't believe it. The Italian Navy has an archive, and you will be able to go and consult the lists. It's incomplete. What they won't tell you is they have another secret archive, in which all the interesting stuff But I'm sure there's another one behind that one, because where is all the intelligence material? They say they haven't got it. I think they've got it. So Russian dolls and mirrors.
Well, but you know, there's an interesting angle to that, because one of the things I found in the Russian archives is that this business that I talked about yesterday about institutional memory and the plans that are on the shelf, because institutional memory tended to die out, periodically an officer would be tasked to do a historical survey of previous planning efforts to show where they were or how they got up to where they were. And the problem is that historians like Zajnczkowski come in and they accept that as truth. And if there are errors, either deliberate or not deliberate, in those summaries, then the errors will enter the historical record, the written, the published historical record. But the interesting thing is, for the in the Soviet period, in the somebody, I don't know who, gathered all of the war plans for the interwar period, and they're assembled in a file about this thick. I mean, they're the conceptual summaries. Mm. They're not the. And I saw that once, and it is now disappeared back into the bowels of the Soviet or of the Soviet period archives. But that is the only compendium I have ever seen of the war plans for the interwar period. And luckily, I got Xeroxes of most of them. But, I mean, that's another story. But what happens is the staff itself keeps files so that the influence of those that past planning effort tends to influence color and so on, the way in which they approach the current planning effort. And it did so both in the imperial period and then in the Soviet period.
Sir John, don't be so modest. Like Dick said, you know, tell us, you know, the stuff you said is the first time a lot of this is out. If you just indicate a little
right.
bit what the historian's craft is to get at the Italian story, I think it would be terrific.
Okay. I think that should go in a good solid paragraph up front, right. not in a footnote. I mean, this is methods used and problems.
The same for you, Bruce.
Yeah. I think everybody. Yeah. You know, should do that in one way or another, and maybe add a, you know, we're talking about 90 plus years after the fact.
This will give me some inclusion as well to pull that together. Mm-hmm.
You know, the untutored reader thinks, you know, people have been in the archives, they assume everything is there,
yeah.
you know, it's just a matter of digesting it.
The other,
let them know.
The other thing is coming off of one of your earlier comments, Dick, is, and I don't want to really get into a long food fight right now about it, but we sometime, I guess, as we sculpt our pieces or re-sculpt them, we're going to have to decide how much technical detail we want. Because, for example, Doug's not here, but my impression, for example, of the French mobilization, troop mobilization system is, in contrast with the Russians, where you're in this long exercise of assembling locomotives, rolling stock, that the French very quickly are able to mobilize their railroads, and they almost run on a racetrack routine where you don't have to worry about having specific trains and all of that, where it's just as the troops are assembled and everybody's accounted for, they're put on the trains and it's a process that just keeps moving. And one wonders about how important it is to get to that level of detail so that the readers understand the varying complexities of the technical side as you're getting into some of these, you know, problems related to deployments and so on.
No easy solution to this question. I would like to know a lot about the railroad. Just can't see how we're going to add
a few paragraphs.
All of that
guessing.
I think it might be worth perhaps something in your introduction or your conclusion, because I mean it opens up this question, doesn't it, of war by timetable? And when you were talking yesterday, we were talking some about railway things. The phrase shot through my mind. You will know it. R. H. Tawney, who was actually talking about the Chinese War in the '20s, said a general with a railway is like a monkey with a watch.
That's the old German.
The danger might be that over concentrating on technical details of railways might encourage people to think it's war by timetable, and maybe what we want to do is say, you know, that there are, because as various people have been saying, this is something you can control and plan, and you have to. They are working on this, but it is only a very subordinate part of the story.
We don't want to get into the N plus 5, N plus 8, N plus 9 kind of analysis in this, but really into the how are the plans made, who has input, the nature, the process of
process.
Planning.
Process, mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I think that we need to talk about, though, with respect to railways, is the sense that means determine ends. You can only fight a kind of war that you've prepared for. You can only fight a kind of war that you have. Once you buy the equipment, it determines what you can do. And the same way with these railways. You have railway planning. It, of course, is determined initially by what you anticipate the war is going to be. But once you have the planning done, it determines what kind of war you can fight. War by timetable, in a sense, because the timetables don't determine the war. But what kind of war you can actually do is determined by the timetables, in that sense, once you've decided what you have to do. It doesn't push one way, it pushes both ways. Mm-hmm. It's both a determiner and a determinant, in that sense.
But what's, going to the technical side for a moment, and getting back to our debate yesterday about the nature of war plans, what was a plan, and so on. Essentially what, and maybe I'm sort of too much colored by looking at the one side for too long, but essentially once you have a situation where your intelligence is basically going to fairly clearly identify the areas of concentration for the other guys, where the technical thing comes in, if the decision is made you're going to go on the offensive initially and not defend and then shift to counteroffensive, then what that means is you have, really the technician's job is then to come up with where your areas of concentration will be on your side of the border, and that is driven by what the rail net looks like. And so if you enter any changes in that, the technical side really, for the general staff officers, revolves around looking at how many traverses on foot it is to get from those areas of concentration to your initial then strategic deployments. And so it becomes a technical calculus of carrying capacities and what the size of the formations and so on you want in the areas of concentration. And essentially the rest of this going back is governed by the troop mob, the schedules, and the rail transit plan. So war planning, what happens is why we run into that problem with overall aims and so on is very quickly the process has devolved down from establishing overarching war aims and end states to really the job of the technician is not to worry about those, it's to worry about this. It becomes a Clausewitzian kind of thing where you're looking for Schwerpunkt. Schwerpunkt is always main concentration of enemy force. And so objectives in this kind of planning process become to simply identifying military objectives, and military objectives essentially defined as enemy main force, and then what you need to do to contend with that. So when the Russians use that term soborozhenia, which means considerations, this is the part of the war plan, the concept part that always gets the emphasis rather than the overarching statement of everything that the nation or the state wants to bring about in future war. So that's why we get this in the Russians. That's why all of this, the war plans become known by the MOB-SCHED numbers and so on, because they're the ones that bring you up to there.
Can I suggest something? Do we have the last question on Italy? And how about a break and then larger issues?
Holger and Bruce are going to be picked up at Harrison House at 12. They'd have to leave here about 11:45. So I think we have effectively about 1 hour of work time left.
Probably.
So let's take a 10.
Well, you got off lightly.
Well,
John, I tell you.
I'm happy.
Between,
things like three of
the. And I think one of the really interesting things for me is how I've repiggered what I'm going to do by listening to these guys.
that's the whole point of getting
really
together.
Or is it regimental?
What was really striking to me was that by the time polio was so anxious to avoid the general staff, the overstretching of the limited force, well, you had to be a because there might be a contingency, and then over a period of your evolving service career with whom you served. And then underlying all of that is this nasty kind of calculus that Norman Stone talks about, you know, is, and he overemphasizes
deployed
in overseas, you know, the other. I mean, that is a factor, but it doesn't play quite the important role that he talks about. And, you know, it's like,
well, the Great
Fuller
War,
says, you know, the guards officers reviled the field officers, the cavalry reviled the infantry, the artillery fought superior to everybody else there.
Now, what I need to ask you, I mean, I'll email you and ask you, but this argument that's an unresolved argument in what has been written by Italian historians about whether when Alberici went to Vienna, he actually knew there was
not only
an undertaking given to Conrad that he opposed to at the end of July to send Italian troops.
Grow up because
it's,
for example, even for me, like when you have
this,
a gathering
put in
of
a bit
historians,
of it in footnotes, but the Italian records
don't say any more than that. And
whether,
so
whether
on,
it
so
really
on.
Exists,
so you're
whether
it's
an invention
of a project and thinking about the guys you
know
that are reliable, with whom you have a good working relationship.
Even if
you have some differences, you know they're not insurmountable.
And you know they'll
give you a product. And really, if you look at a practical guy like Alexeyev, who's late, or not Alexeyev, Sukumlinov, who's lazy, he's basically, he's a great guy.
Well, that's the best kind. And great guys were lazy to always figure out ways so they can remain lazy.
But he delegates everything out, makes pretty sound decisions, with the exception of the one thing that I brought out in that little essay is the nastiness of the power relationships. Is that if you're going to work for somebody else, there are no other loyalties.
You're either.
And if you're 70,000
Well, but why it only worked in how should I say, irregularly, or was because what would happen would be the Tsar would see some old guy in there that he was worthless, but he was loyal, and the Tsar would intercede.
Well, that's like when, Norman still makes his point when, Ruski gets canned. They bring in somebody older than him. He's 87 or something. They bring in an 89-year-old or whatever the hell it is, just to make sure that no one thought he was removed because he was too old.
But you know, really, I agree with that. But you know, if somewhere, I don't know whether Zajnchukovsky. See, Zajnchukovsky was starting to work on that right before he died, and he published an initial chapter on it in about the 1980s, sometime in there. That's PA, not AM.
Yep.
And I started working back through the materials that he was using to get at it in the archives. But now what you've done is you've given me a correlative way of going in and checking on that. But for example, what you will see is the average age of the General Officer Corps probably dropped by 10 years or more.
Yep, absolutely. But the Tsar liked to save sort of old friends and
well, but you get guys like Grippenberg, you know, he's deaf, cranky.
But the Baltic Germans were always loyal. Thus, you can stay.
Yeah, but that's another thing I didn't bring up about this elite contention. What you have in the general staff is a distinct bias against anybody who has a German-sounding name.
Yeah. And of course, there's always the problem with Finns, too.
That's because, yeah, well, but that with the Germans, it's more jealousy.
Yes.
With the Finns, it's a question of loyalty.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's really a lovely army. It's so fascinating. Have you ever done much work on the on Sidorov's stuff about munitioning and finance and such like that? Which I really enjoy both those books.
You know, there's that plus what I have done is taken Gattrell's work pretty much because I just don't have enough time.
Peter Gattrell is an old friend of mine.
Yeah,
we were at Cambridge.
His work is absolutely first rate.
It is nice stuff.
And the my only issue with it is he organizes his coverage funny so that you have trouble making sense out of leaps and gaps that he makes. But nonetheless, it's still a great book.
You see, when I was at Cambridge, I was doing my first book, my thesis, on the strategy and supply of the First World War,
mm-hmm.
and Peter was working on the pre-war, so he was working with D.H. Carr. However, and I was working with Norman Stone, so sort of, because Peter didn't get along with Norman at all. Norman was a lousy supervisor in many ways. He was perfect for me. I was 26, I was married. I wanted people to leave me alone.
That's right, non-interventionist.
Well, his supervision in mine was every two weeks I'd go to Jesus. We'd play squash.
Yep.
He'd say, how's it going? I said, fine.
Yep.
And the first thing he ever saw of mine was the thesis. And I gave it to him, and he read it over, and he said, that's fine.
Yeah, well, that's I understand.
How lots of people like having their hands on I just wanted to be left alone.
But the big thing that I need to get into is I need to go back to the Manikovsky stuff.
Yep.
And really identify the major changes they made in the intendance service. And then go back to I think it's Barsukov on artillery. Because it's only a superficial look, but what I did was I went back and looked at their methodologies for calculating usage rates and so on, and what they did to put it in place. And then if you go to those old wartime trials and so on, Sukumlinov just said, hell, you know, we did an analysis, we put our best wisdom to it.
Well, the thing is, they're as good as anybody else at guessing.
Yeah.
Theirs is no worse than the Germans or the British or the French.
But see, that's where the short war stuff comes up.
Yep.
Because essentially, I think what we're going to come down to is there's a range of opinion. But the majority of it came down on the side of the short war scenario. And by short war, I mean a year and a half.
Well, that's why when the war breaks out, and apparently there's going to be some shortages, they're unwilling to give contracts to Russian firms because they'll get gouged.
Yes.
So they go to America.
And you'll get gouged.
And get gouged.
But at least you'll get a product.
Well, but the trouble is, of course, all the Americans want money up front,
yes,
to build factories, which aren't available.
But
there was a Canadian one that I wrote up in the Slavonic and East European Review in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
There's a contract for 5 million 3-inch shells. And essentially, these foreign contractors are crooks of the first order. But the trouble is that this affects everybody. And it's not until the spring of 1915, after the retreat, when the Tsar is sort of battered out, he buys off all of his political opposition by sort of borrowing money from the Petrograd bankers, giving contracts to Russian guys, and he weakens all the Duma opposition.
Yeah.
Gets sort of the progressive bloc collapses.
But this is why, and I really will, I won't quite go to such colloquial usages as rollback and so on. But what you have to understand is the business between the Grand Duke and the Tsar doesn't end in 1908 when the Tsar remands the Grand Duke.
It ends in 1915.
Well, yes. And the issue always is when you start drawing the boundaries of the fronts backwards.
Yes, how far back?
Well, yeah, and to what degree the power of the supreme or the commander in the field essentially subverts the power of the Tsar.
Well, Daniel Graf's article about how far back does the war go?
Yeah.
I mean, it explains why the Tsar wasn't stopped.
Exactly. Exactly. And
it's not a stupid mission.
Yeah, and David Jones and Oleg Aryapyatov are among those who have written fairly lucidly about that. Because of the problem with the political.
No, absolutely. It's all a political question.
Yeah.
I mean, because given the structure of Russian government, the Tsar is the only one who can adjudicate between these conflicting things. Minister Hu, Ways and Communications, has the trains to hear. And the Quartermaster General has it up there.
Yep.
Like any good Quartermaster General, he hides trains. Won't release them.
2003.
Yeah, and I've forgotten. Then you have the one general, and I've forgotten which one it was, who when they went out to stop Varanovich, all he does is spend his time looking at his private pornography collection.
Not as bad as the Romanians, who have to decide at which rank you can wear makeup.
Yeah.
But that's another issue.
we're not called
field rank.
We have
there.
A field rank.
1 hour.
Field
rank.
Yeah. Absolutely. Majors.
That's right. Majors enough.
Yeah.
And now is our time for general discussion of things that need attention, things that need emphasis.
Can I ask one question? You told us
8,000. You can ask one question.
Well, no, I'm usually incapable of asking only one. But you said 8,000 words, so I stopped at 8,000 words. Actually, can we write more?
Forget about that.
Well, in pages, what's 8,000?
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, in pages,
I think of words, not pages.
I was thinking of words.
That's 4,000.
Look, I think
so. That's 32 pages.
Just extemporizing. Let's think 40, 45, 50 pages.
So is that about 10,000 words?
Oh, no, it's clearly a new 12 font to you.
Yeah. I was just going to propose a range of 40 to 50 and sort of see how it works out. But, I mean, that's
double spaced.
Yeah, that's about 10,000 words probably.
Yeah, yeah. Let's think 40 to 50.
Yeah, okay. And we, you know, like I said yesterday, we would prefer endnotes, double space, one inch margins.
Yep.
You want page numbers, bottom center is just fine. If we use Courier New 12, which everybody did.
Default. Except me.
Well, I changed
it. You changed
the size, because then we know, I mean, we all know the tricks of using which font and point 11 and how we can get a lot more. Then we know how much exactly everybody is roughly right. We're not going to get one 80-page or 40-page chapter.
Why, what does Word default to on font? Isn't it New Times Roman?
Yeah, mine does. Yeah.
Instead of, well, I don't want to enter a huge change, but I mean,
for some reason, the last project we did, Courier New, so Richard used it again, and everybody used it, so that's
well,
fine.
But you guys can change that anyway with a flick of the buttons, you know, so it's not that big a deal.
But do make it endnotes and double space them, please.
Because that's what Chris wants.
For how to do it, just look at the Cambridge University book.
Yeah.
Use their house rules for style.
Style, okay.
Yeah. And in yours, I changed to U.S. spelling.
I was about to say, I can't, I'll have to do it in English spelling, and you'll have to change it.
John, to do just that. That thing at the bottom that says English, and then it says which variant. But, I mean,
well, all right, if you press me, I don't want to change it.
I have run up against that before with my British and European colleagues.
Send me the bill to the Leeds wine cellar, and I'll do it for you.
Okay.
The second big issue, and the editors may just kill me for this, but I am suggesting, Dick said yesterday August. Yes, I could deliver in August, but I'll tell you what, it would be better because I have another shot at the archives for little fine-tuning at the end of August, beginning of September. I would prefer an end of September or mid to end of September delivery date as a kind of a real drop dead. Now, if that screws you guys up, okay, I'll fall in. You know, I understand military procedures.
Should we make an exception in this case?
Oh, absolutely.
No, okay.
I haven't started writing my piece either.
Well, but it's worse yet because I was talking with Steve.
In July, I'm in Australia. After that, I would have the whole month to write that thing. Until the end of August. Some thing to do.
Yeah.
End of August would be nice.
Would be nice for all of us.
At least the end of August, early
mid-September. Let's put it down for a first of September.
Yeah. And then we can fudge if we have to. But
Have you guys thought what direction you're taking here?
Nope.
Pretty much open on that.
And the reason is, I purposely did not write one word. I said, I'm coming to Columbus. Mm-hmm. I got a lot of the papers to read. I was gone out of the country the week before. So some of them I read on the plane coming here. So Keith, I said, let's get here. Let's get the benefit of a day and a half of discussion, all the papers. It'll be a thematic one, you know. What do the papers have in common? What are the uniquenesses of some of the case studies? But I said, I'm not starting a word on the conclusions, or I've heard everyone that have read the papers.
Can I raise an issue about that? I think,
please.
And it's only just a thought for you guys, but I mean, it's a question of the historiography and this volume, isn't it? Because we've all used different bits of it. There's a mass of historiography about war planning.
But if you think about where it's got to collectively, I don't think it's got very far.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said something about the Paul Kennedy volume, which is, you know, had its uses, but and we've got a lot of books and so on, but what I'm trying to get round to is whether you think it's appropriate to say something about the historiography, partly because I think we maybe will bounce it one big step forward with this book, not least because of the collaborative nature of what we've done.
It does sound like something for chapter one, right?
Yeah, it's for chapter one. And the reason in our proposal we put Kennedy in, I mean, the first thing any publisher is going to say is, well, what's the rival, what's the last on that? So we sort of started off, you know, here's the great book of 1979 that's a long time ago, and of course it's got stuff on there other than 1914, etc., because we wanted to head that comment with Frank Smith right off at the top.
Yeah. Can I make a suggestion both on the introduction and the conclusions? On the historiographical bit, what I would argue is that possibly the authors themselves, sometime in the next few weeks, month, might send a short description of those historiographical works that are most influential in their specific area, with a few words about them, with emphasis on the, unfortunately, pardon me, European colleagues, the English language works, and then the few major foreign language works, so that we help Richard and Holger out on this, so that we don't come back and you see that historiographical overview and say, oh shoot, it doesn't have this, doesn't have that. And
that's a great idea. Would you guys like us also to put in the back, as we did in our volume, just a short listing of English language books? This again would help tremendously.
I think it would, especially for the students.
That's who I'm thinking of, John.
Yeah.
You know, and again, the language problem is always there, so you know, if you can send us, look at that volume on World War One. We did it, English language for, you know, each case study, had the authors give us, say, 10 titles or so, depending how many you have. It would be a great help to us.
Yeah, and the other thing I would suggest is, if possible, I know you guys would be driven by deadlines and so on, I wouldn't mind seeing your draft of your conclusions to see whether I agree with them or not. I mean,
what are you going to do if you don't?
Well, at least enter.
Hey, wait a minute.
At least enter in an objection. But again, coming from the military culture, I understand the imperatives of command, and in the end, you guys are the commanders. Yep. So I mean,
absolutely. And like I said, of the individual chapters, when they come in, when Richard and I go through them, they go back to you and you tell us, this is fine what you did, this is wrong, I want it exactly as I have it.
We do not wish to see a statement in chapter 2 contradicted by a statement
exactly,
in chapter 5.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And what I would argue in the last sort of major
and
point,
the intro and the conclusion,
and I will try to hold my peace, is that I would suggest that, again, going back to yesterday, since we're talking about process and products, that the orientation of the introduction should be geared in that way, and then the other things, elite analysis and so on, should fall out as subsets of that. Now, maybe, again, I put that forward to so that you may entertain it. Now, at the same time, it's very facile to throw in that graphic from it was what we call Joint Pub 3.0 on joint operations and what that looks like. The problem is it sort of clarifies your thinking about planning process. The same thing with that raw understanding of strategy, orchestrating and linking ends, ways and means. However, the downside, it clarifies your thinking on one level. The downside is that it tends to show that process as linear. It does not plug in the feedback loops and the iterative process that's involved with those. It's like Cohen's comment about failure to adapt, failure to learn, failure to anticipate. he said, if I would rethink that, I would like, I would concentrate much more on the interaction among those elements as the situation unfolds. So what I would argue is that take a look at that first couple of pages of my sort of thoughts on paper. And what I'll try to do is, if anybody really wants to go into that deeper, I can just give you the site out of the joint pubs and so on. But what I would argue is that for me, for most of the authors, that should stay almost like a Hemingway exercise. That is, when Hemingway says, what's more important is what you choose to leave out, and yet allow in your the back of your mind to affect the way that you treat the materials.
Four things that I would like to raise. Number one, I did that yesterday, war plans. We still haven't decided what it actually means. So I suggest for the time being we're talking about war planning.
Mm-hmm.
Now this, if you do this, you cannot do it without putting in politics. So I guess this is important. I mean, we are talking about what the Prussian General Staff called operational planning, or that sort of plan. This is, I mean, this is something like the Schlieffen Plan. So we're talking about armament policy. That's very important. We're talking about the tenets of economic and financial planning, and we're talking about what the politicians have to say about all this. What ideas they have. But I think this is something we should agree on, that we not just stick to the nitty-gritty of mobilization plans and so on, but show the whole picture.
My immediate reaction is you're absolutely right. It sounds like an ideal title for the book, War Planning, 1914.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and
good.
That's
number one. Number
agenda.
Two, Navy. Except for you two, mainly, most of us had rather concentrated on the army. And I don't think that's really a good idea. On the German case, of course, I told you yesterday, on the one hand, of course, you have war planning in the sense that armament policy and the idea what on earth is the battlefield for. Actually, not for war. That's the interesting thing. It's the idea is to use it as a means of pressure in politics. Which is also why the operational planning of the Admiral Staff in Germany is somewhat shaky.
I would disagree. It's very precise. And they're called Operation Plan 1, 2, 3, down to precise landings on Cape Cod and New York City, etc. Yes, they're pie in the sky, but you know, they actually have war plans.
So what he should do is, like in World War II, the invasion of Brazil.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think we should also be fair to the Navy. Take them into account.
We're applicable.
Question number three, planning. When do we start? There's a book in Germany written by Manuel Geis about the origins of World War I that begins in 1850.
Sorry?
I would say 1648.
Exactly. So, is there any year or, so to say, turn of the century as a mark, for example, which we can agree on? Or is it different?
It starts with the Russo Japanese War, after which, you know. One threat is removed.
But in that introductory, in that thought piece, what I did was I said, you have to understand what happened. Here's a paragraph on what came before. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
John basically starts when you get a general staff and the four occupants.
What I'd like to do is to begin in spring of 1871, with all that discussion about long and short war, and then as far as the planning period is concerned, to really concentrate on the beginning of the 1890s. So, the development of planning.
I think we have to leave this one open and It's going to be slightly different in each
case. Every case is unique.
And use your judgment, but, you know, obviously within the span allowed, as the Camp Beach fact too.
I was just going to say, what's going to happen is that 40 to 50 page limit is going to drive how we determine the elements in there, like a rail transit plan will drive what the troop mobile schedule looks like and so on,
And if you guys would just put in a word on, you know, the sort of October period for the 19,000 out of the 20,000 readers are going to say, well, what the hell happens to the plans? And in your case, John, if you agree, my suggestion, what you have in your book, that when they do go to war, they come up with one hell of a plan.
Great.
You have tea with Gunter in 3 weeks. On the menu.
And a little skiing in between.
And I think we can add in the introductory chapter at least a paragraph on why the word plan should be put in quotation marks.
Right.
Spell that out from the start.
Yeah. And we're going to do what are general staffs, some old ones, some latecomers to the process. Maps, again, if you can use CUP, you raised a wonderful issue yesterday while Rick Herman was there. He was very non-committal.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Didn't hear a voice.
Because they're free for the West Point, and of course you have your...
I have the digitized basis for the East.
John, in your case, I would suggest we really kind of need to have...
freehand, then you need to take...
I mean, a crucial question is, how many maps? Do you want one, if
I don't have Serbia?
Six maps.
Let's try for that.
$4,000.
I don't think I need a map. The British one.
Map of the world.
Yes, for our possessions.
What about a map of northern France with a lot of place names there?
And the obvious thing is, make sure what you raise in your essay we get on the map. But the Rhone, the Mount, Provence, Galicia, and a couple of forts are where Lorraine is.
Yeah. But you know the problem, for example, with that International History Review piece, I did not have enough time to sit down and cartoon on a overlay for the cartographer what the Alexeyev note of 1912 would have looked like on a map. And that's something that I'll go back and include.
Okay. You know, and then we just rely on you and keep Richard Lee posted, please. Because like I said, we don't want this to be a 2008-2009 production. We want to get it to Frank, and we want to get it while it's fresh.
Can I go back to the naval thing? Because I think what I'd like to get clear in my mind is whether, and there are different ways of doing it, aren't there? That's the problem. From Keith's asking me questions, I start to develop the idea of how the naval dimension fitted into the general strategic problem as the Italians see it. Another way of doing it is to take a much more land-based approach, but say, in what ways does the Navy contribute to, or not contribute to, producing solutions for a set of problems that are essentially or centrally land-based? I think because you know, there's a bit of a danger of being drawn out into quite a wide ocean, really. Because you know, if you discuss naval planning, have you got to discuss something about the Navy's conceptions of strategy into which they're... So it would be helpful to, if it's possible, to have some sort of idea of how far to go.
And may I give you a suggestion, perhaps, a helpful view of this? I know it's kind of dangerous because it makes our approach a little bit deterministic, but nevertheless. Why don't we concentrate on those parts of the story that are actually important for 1914 and 1915? And that means, well, for Britain, of course, the Navy is important, for Germany it's not. And for Austria, it's not very important either. Yeah? So
Right.
He can limit, on that ground, he can limit the emphasis that he put on the Navy.
That's a good idea.
He still needed in order to explain what's going on with the armies and the budgets and so on. But
you could put it in the perception. Yeah. Or you might raise the word, if we're going to Provence, how are we going to get
How are we going to get there?
Yeah. John's plan B, at the discretion of the author, sounds like a pretty good solution, I think.
Yeah.
Is that, because it's from where I've taught for the last 10 years, is that the Navy ought to appear in there, but what the salience of the Navy is, it should be left up, probably with preference to the Stieg, John, as it figures into plans, but, don't do a naval general staff review.
Yeah, exactly, Bruce. Mm-hmm. Just like, what year do we start? I mean, you guys are the experts on all these plans. And so you guys and the Navy, these are your cases. So you decide. We don't have, this is the schema. We're not doing the Schlieffen plan here. You decide when planning becomes important. Who does it? To what degree does the Navy enter it? Do politicians? Do finances? Richard and I sort of put out a guidance essay, but that's what it is. Because we rely on each of you to pick out the important stuff, and we understand the cases are unique. That's the value of this book. If they weren't, we wouldn't be here.
A single person.
Here's a question that I was thinking about. To what extent, particularly this applies to me, I don't know what it does for the other, do I talk about post-belligerence planning? Because for the British, ideas like business as usual, they don't think about it before the war starts, but within a month, they're immediately thinking about, well, Jesus, now that we're in this war we never expected to be in, they're immediately trying to create war plans, as it were, for this. Should I mention stuff like that?
Yes, I think.
But, for up to Christmas time of 1915.
After implementation, what is that room?
Rethinking.
Outcome. This is an outcome.
Actual outcome.
Yeah.
See, there's no actual outcome in British case of pre-war plans except the brief ones that I mentioned, but there's an immediate creation of post-war plan, of post-belligerence plans, and it's very quick. Yeah. Now, I could do that quickly, in half a page or something like that.
Yeah, wonderful.
I think a final paragraph signaling what happened next.
Yep.
Yes, okay, good.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Because that comes up to something I've forgotten, and that was just, again, in quotes, humble recommendation for that chapter one, is that I think for the most part you should probably talk about ranges in large subject areas, like ranges of thinking over what the nature of a war plan was. Ranges of general staff organization and so on, because it's not your job to really define those, but it's the individual authors then that will find a place inside those ranges in various subject areas.
General staff is.
Yeah, ranges of thinking about protractedness. And then let the individual guys pick up, where they see the preponderance and so on in their in their own area.
That's a great idea, because in the other project we did, we found out every author had a chapter on the Balkan Wars. Or chapter within the chapter.
It was hard to get rid of some of them.
It was hard to get rid of some of them, but we managed.
Wars couldn't go away.
That's what's rendered great, though. You just couldn't get rid of them.
That's all. Of course. Gee, we're still in the Balkans, aren't we?
Indeed. So now that makes me ask, could we then have some sort of a draft even of the revised intro before we have to get it done by the 1st of September? Or at least the sort of points?
About the retiree summer travel plan.
You're not going to be here, Dick.
I'll do what I can.
Yeah, I mean, even just, you know, just a series
of questions. Well, it sounds like Paul says, what's the comrade in Carl's
class? I'll do what I can. Send you
we're
a message
not
from Galicia.
Yeah,
that's in Spain.
Oh, right.
Well, but,
right.
That, but that's another argument for, without going overboard, to just sort of stalling the thing, you know, until end of August, beginning of September. That gives you a little bit of time to...
Oh, he's a crafty man.
I have to change the subject. Somebody in the audience yesterday raised a question about rational choice analysis and indicated all problems would be solved and so on. It strikes me, as my inclination, the best thing to do is avoid it entirely.
Yep.
So if we all agree, we'll not use that phrase. Now, we can use rationality and logic and so on, you know, but indicate we're essentially using 1910 notions as opposed to 1990. I think it'll make our task much easier.
A footnote to that, and it's sort of risk assessment. This is where I tend to go. Basically, all decisions are rational. It just depends upon what the factors are that are entering into the rational calculus. But where I start to fault guys is when the risk curve goes way up and there doesn't seem to be a recognition of, oh, shoot, you know, we've now reached the stage at which 60%, you know, or 70% success, it goes down.
Mm. One decision maker said 90% chance that.
But there is. I mean, then you can begin holding people rather accountable for the decisions they make.
That is an interesting question about your conclusion. That's why I raised this issue of historicism and other people. What do you think the nature and extent of the critique is going to be of the people we're talking about? I'm very reluctant to criticize people outside their own time. But there is a function in doing so.
Reading
I can see
the
that.
To the Origins book that I wrote. In there, I used the conclusions of the authors in their case study.
Right.
And it wasn't age three ranting and raving. It was the conclusions of the authors and then trying to draw out some parallels, similarities, and dissimilarities.
Right.
And also, John, a kind of an antidote.
And it will be sent to you, Sir John.
Antidote to that is to be, I tend to look at the actors through the eyes of their contemporaries, but not too far down the line when they start rationalizing everything. So, for example, in the archives, you can actually run into memoranda that Danilov wrote September, October, November 1914, where he says, oh, shoot, you know, all the calculus we did on this was incorrect. Now, I'll take his own judgments and use them to assess what they did before. But if you look, for example, at that critique of Golovin, he's got axes to grind already by the late 1920s and early 1930s, and you've got to kind of put up filters and figure out what they are.
But everybody refights World War One no more than the Royal Navy.
May I briefly come back to that question of rationality? Well, I do not intend to use the R word in that article, but what I'm going to do is I let these guys speak for themselves. Meaning that, I have plenty of material like this. I just quote them. And they're talking about how nice it would be to have a world war. The world alive and God knows what. Unbelievable stuff. My question to you, I mean, do you have similar material which you could also put into your article in order to just show the mindset of these people?
Well, easy.
I mean,
virtually not at all. Other than the occasional bits that come out of the meetings with the German and Austrian chief of staff and the letters that are otherwise virtually no, couldn't do it, don't have the materials.
My reading on the subject is the heart of the enterprise is we're not faulting people for making mistaken decisions and certainly not long after the fact. I see this book as a communication to our contemporaries and people who come after us. And we are asking them to think about these processes in a somewhat different way. Now, they don't ordinarily think in terms of different, separate, autonomous elites, and they don't ordinarily think about the question of coordination. Max Weber, a man who has great influence everywhere, talks about a fully developed bureaucracy. I mean, that sounds like a marvelous thing, but it doesn't match anything that we're looking at. So we're inviting them to set Weber on the shelf and think about it in a more open-minded way. I think there is an article I cite in, I think it's footnote 11 in this chapter, and it's by Chamberlain, and it's called The Need for Alternative Hypotheses. It is an astonishing article. It appeared in Science magazine. It has been published 4 times there in the course of the century. It is still worth looking at. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what we're doing, is we're asking people to think about it in a different way, mm-hmm. not just think about it. It's, you know, let's ask whether this is an appropriate way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the final plea to all of you, please never, ever write "the Germans followed the Schlieffen Plan." The Germans followed the Schlieffen Plan in 1949.
Yeah, promise.
That was modified.
Kröner was absolutely right. It was the Great Symphony, just the wrong conductor. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, when John and I were in Newport, the first thing the students ask is, "What's the class solution?" There is none there. There is none here. You know, the richness of this text is going to be the uniqueness of the chapters, the uniqueness of your research, your contribution, and the conclusion is just going to be the attempt to wrap that up for the reader. It will all come out to you. So, you know, again, you've got carte blanche where you want to start, to the degree you want to bring navies in, because, you know, this is your chance. You've done all sorts of years and years of research on this to reach a wider English language audience to, you know, really from the richness of your knowledge expound.
And Stig, I would like to see Lieutenant Colonel Hinch appear in your narrative, but that's just...
Tell you what, this guy is not really important.
He only died in Romania. Who needs him?
I'll tell you what, the final thing, the ostrich. It's November 19, I think it's November 1914. I'm telling the Chancellor, the army is the broken instrument. So that's the outcome.
I didn't hear the word.
Sorry? Falkenhayn, November 1914 to Bethmann Hollweg. Bethmann asks him how the whole thing is going, will be going on next year. He tells him the army is a broken instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that is really the question of outcomes until fall 1914.
And that's interesting because essentially the contents of Danilov's memo in December 1914 were finished. But, you know, this...
Well, I mean, this is, you know, Falkenhayn's comment, as sarcastic as he is, to get back to Zuber, you know, when the thing ends at the Marne, he says, Schlieffen's notes are at an end. And, you know, Moltke has no more ideas.
And this is interesting that you should say this. This is the basic idea for Volume 3. German army is at an end, the Russian army is at an end, the Austrian-Hungarian as well. So
the Italians haven't begun and the British have yet to really get in here.
That's right. When conventional war crosses the boundary to people's war.
Yeah. You read in all the official histories, including official British history, the old army's at an end, the best non-coms are gone, the best officers are gone. I mean, everybody thinks 1916. No, those 4 months in 1914 are the great killer.
Yep. I would argue the Russian Revolution begins about December 1914.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fully agree. Mm-hmm. You know, yet we sort of oh, yeah, well, there were these skirmishes, the, quote, race to the sea, and then we get down to the really bad years of the war, and your boys out there take the heaviest hit.
Yep, true. The noble officer corps of the Prussian Army.
You know, yeah. I've got to write a short encyclopedia article.
One other question. So that's volume three. That's volume three.
Well, I know
what do we call that?
Most important.
I don't know.
If you don't mind, when I get that draft,
sure, but I have one more question.
It's only about 1,000 words, but I'd like to send it.
We all agree about this, and I think you found it an interesting book. But one more idea, perhaps,
yes,
if that's possible. You want to be had someone writing an article on the Ottoman army?
Yeah. We skirted around one issue. We may have to have someone write an article on it, certainly.
Funnily enough, I talked to Holger about this yesterday.
Yes.
Some of you will know the work of a guy who is just, I have his PhD thesis in my bag, a guy called Ed Erickson, who wrote a book about the Ottoman army during the First World War,
yes.
Sentenced to Die, or something it's called.
Yes.
And then he wrote a very interesting book about the Ottoman army in the Balkan Wars. And I have in my bag his PhD, he's a retired lieutenant colonel in the US artillery, and I have in my bag his PhD thesis, which is about the military effectiveness of the Ottoman army during World War I, with four case studies, Gallipoli. Megiddo, Gaza, Beersheba, and Kut. Mm-hmm. And he is worth thinking about if you think you want a Turkish chapter. He's,
we will turn first to the obvious problem.
Space,
which
time.
I think.
And time, yeah.
Which is going to require the velvet hammer. On the one hand, you know, we'd love you to be here. This is the following. We need it by then. Mm. And then it's going to have to come. If, however, you aren't fully sure you can do it, please, now's the time to say au revoir.
Because I suppose the other, you know, I mean, one of the reasons why I hope Stig's idea is followed up is how nice it would be for us all to do it again with a new set of problems. What are you going to do if Doug Porch can't do it and Bob Doughty's got, where are we, March, April, May, June, July, 5 months?
Bob has done enough on it, I think, John, so that in a sense, if, you know, Doug's got, everybody knows he's got the capacities, whether he's got the time
and the material.
Well, that's the other.
That's why, you know, the March to the Marne, he was an obvious choice. Doty was on our list, Jenny Kiesling, and, you know, other suspects. I mean, as we expressed our great disappointment to him, because, you know, we're not asking him to reinvent the wheel, but to come here and present his stuff, and then we would say, add on to what was in the book, etc. And we got this note, what, 3 weeks ago only, I can't come, and then this disappointing piece. So that's the first issue to be addressed as we fly on our various ways. And we're going to have to be both kind in an offer, but yet very firm in we're not holding up the rest of the team, as so happens, often happens for one person. Yeah. And, you know, as you know from the origins of World War I, one chapter ended up, as reviewers have said, without Italian sources and stuff, because Richard and I leapt into the breach when we were left high and dry.
I've just had recent experience with that, but I will come back and say this. I love Doug dearly. He's a great guy, great scholar. However, on the other side of it, unless Bob's lost his touch, Bob Doty, he is a nasty right to deadline and put your head down and get it through and get it done, and he's a good scholar, so.
Yeah. I know both of them well, and, you know, it's.
A
struggle even more so. This may take a little bit longer. Of course, we need France, without France.
Yes. Without France, no world war.
We'd be sipping
another contingency.
Well, there must be Paris. Somebody to invade for the Germans.
Luxembourg. Actually, Ludendorff had his way Austria.
Wow!
But, that,
but that's a different thing altogether.
But that's
because of this, it may take a little bit longer. Well, it's just perhaps an additional chance to ask somebody like your PhD student to do the Ottoman Empire. Also, the reason why I think it's a good idea, I mean, Volume 1, the charm of it, in part, was of course the fact, I mean, there was articles on Japan, on Bulgaria, and so forth. I read them, great fun, because there was something entirely different from what you usually get. And perhaps we should have a little bit of that in this volume too. And the Ottoman Empire is always underestimated, and nobody really knows something about it.
Yeah.
And it's an absolutely fascinating story.
Yeah.
And if we had Italy, sorry, the guys who only joined in 1915, and so on.
Sure. Ed Erickson. Yeah. Erickson.
If, though, the Ottoman Empire comes in, then Bruce obviously has to start talking about the Caucasian.
I just started to do that in that formative essay, because one of the things that I'm going to do is I'm trying to get away from this sort of idea of the Japanese threat, and what I will introduce I can't say full-blown, but I'll probably have at least a page on the